This Is Actually Happening features real experiences that often include traumatic events. Please consult the show notes for specific content warnings on each episode and for more information about support services.
The feeling is almost of arriving in your adulthood, but being a child. You don't know very much about yourself. And I was terrified to get to know myself as my real self.
From Wondery, I'm Whit Misseldine. You are listening to This Is Actually Happening.
Episode 255. What if they didn't ask and you couldn't tell?
This Is Actually Happening is sponsored by Airbnb. I travel often, and when I'm away, my home never sits empty. I've been an Airbnb host for over 10 years, and it's always been the perfect way to make a little extra money to help supplement my travels while I'm gone. You can even plan around events, like maybe there's a big tournament coming to town and lots of fans will be visiting. You could Airbnb your home or extra room and make some extra money. Your home or spare room might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. Today's episode is brought to you by Audible. Audible is the home of storytelling. In addition to an incredible selection of audiobooks, you'll discover thousands of podcasts from popular favorites to exclusive Audible originals from top celebrities, renowned experts, and exciting new voices in audio. Currently, I'm listening to Killers of the Flower Moon by David Gran after seeing the film and wanting to know more about the story. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/happening or text happening to 500-500. That's audible.com/happening or text happening to 500-500. This Is Actually Happening is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
My mom was born in Paris, Texas. I'm actually the only member of my family that wasn't born in Texas. I was born in Utah. My father was in the Army. He was Special Forces, and so we were relocated quite frequently while they were together. They weren't together for very long. They actually separated when I was 3. Apparently, my father had a lot of anger issues, and it had been kind of escalating to a point where he took a golf club and killed my mother's cat. From what I understand, that was kind of the final straw, and she scooped us up in the middle of the night and we fled. You know, I have a sister who is from a previous marriage, and in kind of a similar fashion, my mother kind of had to flee that person as well. Apparently, they were involved in selling narcotics. But we never really stayed in one place very long. And that beyond the drama that had gone on with my father was because we were so poor, we couldn't really afford to stay in one place for very long. I have memories of living with my uncle and his wife and their 2 kids. But my mother was always working. And so I was kind of left with my aunt and her 2 kids, and I think that we were kind of unwelcome in her eyes. She would come up with some creative punishments for, you know, silly things that kids do. My aunt would heat water up on a stove and then make us put our hand in this near boiling water, and that was our punishment. And of course, my mother never knew that this was going on. By the time she had come home from work, you know, it was well past my bedtime, so I never spent much time with her. I was very shy, and I would describe myself as lost. I feel like I had been missing any kind of guidance, and the kind of parental figures that were there were, of course, my aunt, who would do these abusive things to us. Nobody really explained to me what was going on, and it just left me in a state of confusion. We finally were able to get our own place, but my mother, the amount of hours she worked only increased once we finally got our own place. So I continued this theme of kind of being lost throughout my childhood, and I started to lash out. I would get into trouble with neighborhood kids. We would steal from local stores and skip school and throw rocks at windows and just do all kinds of unruly things. There comes a time where my mother meets this man on the internet, but she was all of a sudden much happier. Their relationship escalated, and we decided to move in with him. But before we moved in with him, we were staying with my mother's sister at her house. And the plan there was for my mother to find a job and set some roots down and establish herself before they got a place together. So she spent months and months trying to find a job in her career field. And I saw the depression just kind of creep into her. It started to take a toll on her sister as well, because we were obviously kind of overstaying our welcome. And so she started lashing out in similar fashion to the other aunt that we were staying with. There wasn't any physical abuse involved with her, but there was a lot of emotional abuse, a lot of throwing dishes and telling me that my mother was ruining things for her. My mother's car had been repossessed. So not only were we taking up her space and her food, we were using her car now to get to the job that my mother had gotten, which was a waitress at some buffet. So it was the beginning of a very dark time for my mother, and I was the one to receive the blame because I was there with my aunt. My mother was always working, and I was the one who could be there to take the blame. There was some fallout between her and the man she had been seeing, this man that was so important to her and was her saving grace, and he became kind of this figure that wouldn't leave her alone, that became a sort of stalker, really. This cycle continued until a significant event where my mother was rushed to the hospital, and I was just so confused, I didn't know what was going on. And so I was left alone for the rest of the night to just kind of wonder what was going on. I didn't learn until several years later what had actually happened. She had been pregnant and she had miscarried. I guess in the process of her miscarriage, she had a significant tear in her uterine wall and she was bleeding out. They just kind of kept me from this in hopes that it would protect me, but in turn, it just kind of did more damage because I was just left alone to wonder what was going on. It just contributed to this lost feeling I had as a child, and I was just kept in the dark about some of these secrets. So at this point, I'm either 11 or 12, and I've just started middle school, and I knew that I was gay. I didn't exactly know what that meant, but I knew that I was different in that way. And I knew that that was wrong. There was not fond conversation of gay people around me, and my aunt was very religious, so it was something that we were taught, you know, is wrong and sinful. I quickly learned that if I didn't share myself with anybody, there was less chance of somebody finding out that I was gay. So I kind of lived in my own head for most of my adolescent years, and I became kind of an outcast for it. But that was okay with me. I could deal with that because it meant that I was protected from being judged for being gay because I saw what gay people were going through. If somebody was suspected of being gay in school, they were bullied, they were beat up, and so I wanted to avoid that at all costs. I quickly, you know, became part of the alternative culture of the teens that I was with. There was a lot of very sad music, dark poetry, and I related to a lot of that material because it spoke to the struggle I was having within myself. But that seemed to further my exclusion from the status quo. I was labeled as, you know, the weird emo kid, the weird goth kid. He's one of those. This is kind of when Columbine was becoming the culture of schools. So I actually, one day at lunch in high school, I sat at a lunch table and I didn't understand that this is where the seniors sat and nobody else was allowed to sit there. But nobody ever said anything to me until one day one of the upperclassmen spoke to me and said, you know, we let you sit here because we're afraid you're going to shoot us up if you don't. I, of course, you know, didn't harbor any violence for anybody, but I was okay with receiving statements like that in a sense because, again, it shielded me from people actually figuring out who I was. By the time that I was in high school, my mother had actually gotten back together with this man, much to my aunt's dismay, and so they had a falling out. So we had moved in with this man into a one-bedroom apartment. My room was the couch in the living room. That was kind of my space. I had this very big crush on this man who was on the football team. There was never any mention specifically of either of us being gay, but he was my first kiss, which unfortunately ended up with me contracting mono, and I was very sick for several months. My mother was so frustrated because I just was not getting better. There was one morning where she had stormed out. I had written her this note that kind of explained what was going on. In the note, I had said, I'm gay, and this is how I contracted mono. And I remember her coming back in after reading the letter, and she was crying, but she just kissed me on the forehead and told me to get some sleep. But very quickly, it turned into questions from my mother of, is this just a phase? And maybe there's something else going on psychiatrically. So I was taken to a counselor. And the counselor told my mother that I didn't have the mannerisms of a typical homosexual, so he didn't think that I was gay. I kind of suspected that she thought that I may grow out of it, or maybe I was just confused, and it was just something that we didn't talk about. I obviously was not comfortable expressing my identity in person, so I turned to the internet. So I spent a lot of time in gay chat rooms just kind of exploring what it meant to be gay, and that led me to this person that I started dating who lived only a couple hours away. So we had been able to meet up, and so that was kind of my first relationship. He had stayed the night, and I remember that my stepdad had been out of town for work or something, and that's why I felt like it was okay for him to stay the night, because I felt like, obviously, we wouldn't get caught. But for one reason or another, he had come home, and he had saw my boyfriend through the door, and he exploded into this rage, and I was kicked out. I went to the mall. That was the first place that came to my mind because I was 15. I called my mother and she was sobbing as soon as she answered the phone because she knew as well that I was not going to be returning. She was financially dependent on him, so there wasn't much she could do because she would end up homeless as well. After that phone call, I had spoken to my sister, who lived in the city in her own apartment, and it was decided that we could come up there and stay in her dining room on an air mattress, and I could work, get a job, and save up some money and try to find her own place. very quickly, I was thrust into adulthood. We worked the whole summer, and miraculously, we got an apartment before the school year started, and I was able to return to school.
Today's episode is brought to you by Audible. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic, 1984, on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother, plus a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Ilan Ishkeri that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've ever heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
When you choose Organic Valley, not only will you be enjoying great-tasting dairy, you'll help to save over 1,600 small organic family farms who are protecting over 400,000 acres of organic farmland and all the plants and animals that call it home. This is dairy you can feel good about. It's great tasting, high quality organic dairy, ethically sourced from small organic family farms. To find Organic Valley Dairy near you, visit ov.coop. That's ov.coop.
My sister decided to enlist in the army, and she seemed happy. She seemed successful. And I thought to myself, you know, maybe that is something that I could pursue. At this time, it's 2009. It's the height of the war in Afghanistan. They really need people to enlist. And so I speak with a recruiter, and I actually have to have my mom sign for me to join because I was still 17. But I went through the whole process, and I enlisted with the understanding that I would be kind of going back into the closet because don't ask, don't tell was still a thing, and you could be discharged for being gay. It wouldn't be honorable, it would be other than honorable. So I shipped out to boot camp in July of 2009 at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, and immediately once you get there, it's people screaming at you and yelling at you, and I'm just taken back to all of the different abusive scenarios that I experienced, and I immediately think, this is a mistake, I've made the wrong choice, I want to leave. But you don't have that option. I was back into this space of, I can't let anybody know who I am as a person, because they'll figure out I'm gay, I'll get in trouble, and I'll be discharged, and all of this will be for nothing. I was still dating my boyfriend at the time, and I had to write these love letters to my partner in this very kind of secretive language that, if read by somebody else, wouldn't make you think that this was a gay couple. Homophobia was, I would say, at the same level as it was when I was in high school. It was very similar. Lots of inappropriate comments that people would make indicating their distaste and hate for gay people. And so I kind of had to put on a mask and become somebody else. Alcohol has a very big role in the culture of the military, and very quickly I found that the alcohol calmed all of that nervous energy that I had building up. I very quickly became reliant on drinking every night to kind of keep me in a kind of medicated headspace. Isolation had become almost part of my core personality, I feel like, because I had been living that way for so long. It was the only way I knew how to be, and so I quickly became fond of drinking alone. I was afraid that, you know, I would say the wrong thing in some sort of drunken stupor and give away that I was gay. I was a very functional alcoholic for several years, so I kind of had this feeling of invulnerability a little bit. So that was kind of a green light for me to keep going. I was trained as a combat medic. We were to be, you know, assigned to hospitals or field hospitals or attached to infantry units. And we were trained to adventure with the infantry and stabilize any kind of trauma that would happen from combat. In the Iraq and Afghanistan war, there was a lot of IEDs and explosions from improvised bombs. So you would see a lot of partial and full amputations of limbs. And a huge focus of our training was being able to stop that bleeding or at least slow it down until they could be taken to a hospital. My role was mainly in hospital environment and clinic environment. But the licensure for medical professionals in the military does not translate to civilian life very well. My licensure in the civilian world would be as a basic EMT. And so that was very discouraging to me because I felt like I did all of this training and work to be able to do pretty much nothing. Unfortunately, the pay for the type of work that I would be qualified in the civilian world was very poor. So I had to kind of adventure out into working as kind of a nurse's aide. I had started initially in an inpatient psychiatric unit. My role there was to maintain a safe environment for the patients who were there, and that involved keeping eyes on everybody at least every 15 minutes, helping those that were actively psychotic or hallucinating, making sure that people were not engaging in unsafe activities. It is so taxing, and you see so many sad stories and so many people who are just victims of the system. They've been sick their whole life and nobody has been able to kind of take good care of them. So they just get bounced around from one facility to the next. So it's very depressing. On top of that, it's dangerous work. You deal with some dangerous individuals who sometimes don't know what they're doing, but can be very violent. And so there was a lot of times where I would be physically assaulted by patients. That was also a major source of stress for me because I was afraid to go to work. I had to go to work because I needed to pay my bills, but I was terrified of getting hurt. And so all of that just contributed to my drinking. My tolerance had kind of built up and I had required more and more. I was frequently sick. It was hard for me to keep solid food down. I would notice that if I went without drinking, that I would start to experience withdrawal symptoms. And so now I'm kind of obligated to keep going in my mind because this is the only thing that makes me feel better. I would not be able to sleep unless I was drunk. I would steal my boyfriend's money and buy alcohol. I would hide bottles in my dresser drawers because I didn't want my boyfriend to know how much I was consuming. And that's a pretty big part of addiction too, is kind of hiding your shame. I had been used to living inside my head for so long that the hiding of my drinking almost came naturally to me. You know, that shame I carried by myself. Nobody else knew what I was going through because I wouldn't let them know. At this point, my boyfriend at the time suspects that I'm an alcoholic, and we have frequent fights about the amount of my drinking every night. And, you know, I would say, oh, I'm going to have only two tonight. And then I would wait until he would go to sleep, and then I would have the other four. But on top of that, my health was kind of getting worse. There were times where I would throw up so violently that I would start bleeding, and I would throw up bright red blood. Even then, it didn't stop me from continuing to drink. When I was graduating from college, I was offered a job in the intensive care unit of a local hospital that was very renowned, and it was a level one trauma center, so it saw all the action. And this was such a great opportunity for me that I couldn't turn it down. But at the same time, my boyfriend had been offered a job in another city. By that point, my alcoholism had taken such a toll on our relationship that once we did end up living apart, it became freeing for him to understand what it's like to live without an alcoholic. And so we very quickly started to grow apart. And not more than 2 months after, it ended up in him breaking up with me. This was the beginning of my descent into my rock bottom. I had all of the stress from work. I lost the one person I felt like I could lean on. I'm throwing up blood more frequently. I'm not eating. I'm not really drinking water. And so it very quickly just spiraled into a very deep depression that I really didn't see any way out of. I felt so isolated and alone, and that nobody would miss me if I were gone. Given my background in psychiatric nursing and in the ICU, I've seen a lot of failed attempts at suicide, so I kind of understood which ways would be better than others, and I started to think about how I would do it. This decision came to be right when COVID began. I remember the first case that arrived in our hospital, and it was on another floor, but I remember feeling terrified, and it very quickly exploded into a huge problem. Everything changed in our day-to-day activity at work overnight almost. All of these COVID patients were dying so quickly, and we didn't understand exactly why they were dying. It's so depressing because these people's families weren't able to be with them as they were dying. It was just you as the nurse and the chaplain on speakerphone as this patient is in their final moments. It really just helped mount my feelings of hopelessness and isolation and suicidal ideation. At this point, I'm working night shift mostly, so I would get off of work early in the morning and arrive at the grocery store as it's opening. I'm wearing my full PPE, and I'm exposing myself and potentially other people to COVID so that I can buy my alcohol for the day. Not really eating or taking care of myself otherwise, and that was kind of my daily ritual. I'd taken off some time from work, and so I just used that week to try to get myself together. I reached out to a suicide hotline. It's a veteran-specific suicide hotline, and I figured they would understand what I'm going through because suicide is so rampant in the veteran community. And so I reached out to this hotline and I broke down crying on the phone with this man. He almost didn't believe what I was telling him. He was telling me things like, you know, you're getting more sleep than that. I think you're exaggerating. And he was getting more and more frustrated with me. He was like, am I going to have to call the police or are you going to be okay? I felt so defeated in that moment that I just said, I'll be fine, and I hung up. I reached out to a friend and explained some of what I was feeling, and so they offered to drive me to the ER to be assessed. I arrived in the ER, they consulted a psychiatrist to come talk to me, and because I didn't have an active plan to commit suicide, they decided that it would be safer for me to be home than in the hospital inpatient because of COVID. And so they sent me home. This was just another level of disappointment. I thought, well, there's nothing I can really do about this except go through with it. Working in the ICU, you have access to a lot of powerful medications, and you have knowledge of how much of certain medications it would take to achieve certain effects. So I came to the plan of using fentanyl, which is a very powerful opioid, to overdose myself and drift off to sleep and die. It was a night shift, and I had taken a large amount of fentanyl that I knew would be enough, and I had stuffed it into my backpack. My plan was to go home after my shift and kill myself in my apartment and just be done with it. You get these medications from a machine called Apixis that dispenses the medication under your username that's attached to your fingerprint. So they know, they can track who has taken what, and all of this is closely monitored given it's our narcotic medication. You can override some of these safeguards to get medications out in an emergency, and then later after the emergency, kind of take care of the discrepancies. So I had overridden all of this fentanyl, and I just put all the vials and, you know, the syringes I would need and everything into my backpack. There was a sense of relief because I knew I would feel better once this was all over. At this point, I was in such a state of, I almost want to say euphoria, because I knew that this would be the end. When you take a medication out by override, it's very apparent on the machine that something has been taken by override. And so nurses that were, you know, just retrieving routine medications to do their own scheduled tasks could see that all of this fentanyl was taken out. And of course, my name was attached to it. I was very quickly kind of questioned about it. They reported me to upper administration, and I was taken into a separate area with the hospital administration and told that I needed to take a drug test. I did this blood test, and it came back negative. And to the administration's dismay, I was kind of released. There's nothing in his system, so why are we keeping him here, sort of thing. And somebody said, well, have they looked in his backpack? And that's when I knew that I was fucked. I turned my backpack over to the hospital security. They discovered the fentanyl vials, and I could see the disappointment in the man's face as soon as he unzipped it, and I knew that that was it. The humiliation and the shame, it had a delayed effect because I did feel so numb at that moment. I could see the disgust on the administrative lady's face. I could see the disappointment in the ER physician's face. And at that point, I just didn't care. I just wanted to go home. I was turned over to the hospital police. The man told me that I would be free to go right now, but that I would need to turn myself in. Of course, I'm not thinking about any of this. I'm just thinking about wanting to die. And so I agree, and I just went home and got drunk. Once I had gotten home, I realized that's the end of my career, and now I have to go through with this, because otherwise, what am I going to do? I wasn't able to stay in that state for very long, because early the next day, the police came looking for me, because I was supposed to turn myself in, and of course I did not. So they knocked on my door initially, and I did not answer. I had no intention of dealing with the police. They ended up leaving after several minutes of knocking on my door, and I figured that they had given up on trying to contact me. But maybe an hour, hour and a half later, there's another knock on the door, and I look through the peephole, and it's the police again, but it's also my landlord. And then my cell phone rings, and it's my landlord. I don't answer it, and she leaves a quick voicemail, and I very quickly open the voicemail to see what it is, and she says, the police are here, they're doing a welfare check, and they're asking for access to your apartment. And the next thing I know, I can hear them jiggling the keys to get in, and so now I'm in a panic. I have nowhere to go, that's the only exit. This apartment was a kind of renovated factory, and so it had really high ceilings and kind of overhead spaces above the closet. And I don't know how, but I was able to climb up into that overhead space, and I hid behind the boxes, holding my breath as they entered my apartment. I knew if they had found me, I would be stuck in a cell and I wouldn't be able to have access to the things that I would need to kill myself. That was my main motivation for hiding. It wasn't necessarily that I was scared of the police officers. It was I didn't want my plan to be foiled. They were about to give up when one of them said, "Hold on, let me look up here." They had gotten up on a chair and moved some of the boxes, and there I was, very disheveled. I hadn't showered. I was still drunk and suicidal, and it became this kind of violent situation where, you know, I had a gun pointed at me and I was being told to get down and get on the ground, and I was handcuffed and taken out to the squad car in front of all of my neighbors and my landlord, and it was just this huge dramatic situation.
When it comes to hiring, don't go searching for the one. Just meet your match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
They saw the kind of graveyard of alcohol bottles in my room. It was just like probably 65 bottles littering the floor and every open surface. They debated with each other whether or not to take me to the hospital, but they were so ramped up, I think, that they just wanted to get this over with. They take me to the police station and I'm wheeled off to the city jail. I was fingerprinted. I had my mugshots taken, all of that humiliating process. And then I went before a magistrate. The magistrate looked over my record and my situation, and he let me go on unrestricted bond, which is just a promise that you'll appear for your court date. And I was very surprised. I didn't think that this would be the outcome of that explosive situation with the police and having guns pointed at me. But there was a huge push to release as many inmates as possible that were, you know, of course, nonviolent, because COVID was so rampant in the prison and jail populations. And so that was sort of my saving grace. I don't think that I would have been released otherwise. And so I was let go, and I'm in the middle of downtown with no ride. I didn't have any money. I started wandering in the direction of my apartment. Eventually, somebody kind of stopped and offered me a ride. The person gave me a ride back to my apartment, and I went back to trying to figure out what my next step would be. I felt like I was at a real crossroad. I could try to gather what's left of my life and figure something out, or I can just go through with my plan to kill myself. And I really debated that for several days until the investigator with the Board of Nursing got in contact with me. I knew that it could potentially be the end of this career that I had gone through so much to achieve. When I met with the investigator, we sat across from each other at this huge conference table, and it was probably the most intimidating experience of my life. She had already talked to all of my coworkers. She had already gotten my medical records. She knew pretty much everything about me. She just wanted to see what I had to say about everything. I had already been arrested. I'm now facing two felonies. I've lost my job. I don't have any money. And so, what do I have to lose by being honest with this lady? So I just laid it all out. And this was probably the only person that I had been able to tell everything to. I told her about the plans I had made to kill myself, and that's why I took the fentanyl. And by the end of our conversation, she was crying. I was so taken aback by this because I thought that this person was against me. I thought this person was not on my side. And here she was weeping for me, and she's telling me that I have so many people that care about me, and all of the coworkers that she talked to told her that I'm a great nurse, and they were so worried about what was going on with me. They could tell that I was dealing with something, but they just didn't know what was going on. She referred me to a monitoring program for licensed health professionals like physicians and nurses and pharmacists who suffer with addiction, and it's a way for them to maintain their license and practice safely, but also to be held accountable. She seemed to genuinely care about my well-being. As I enrolled in the monitoring program, there were certain stipulations that came along with me being able to keep my license. And part of that was attending an intensive outpatient rehab 3 days a week for 4 hours a day of intense group therapy where you get very personal with each other and the counselors. You are kind of forced to open up about these things that brought you to the place where you are now. It was very emotional and scary to tell other people my full story. It was like all of the emotions that I had been numbing were starting to flood back into me. I just remember crying in front of them. There was no judgment. It was just acceptance and love, and it was just exactly what I needed at that moment. I knew for so long that I was an alcoholic, but I couldn't tell other people because it was just so shameful, and it just came with so much stigma. That was such a huge step for me, to be able to tell people that I suffer with this addiction, and they knew exactly what I was going through. I think a big part of me blamed myself for being so isolated all throughout my childhood and early adulthood, because I was gay and some of the hiding was done on purpose. But it was not my fault that I was so isolated by the rest of my family, whether it was on purpose or not. You know, it was still wrong. And it was just so healing to hear that from other people, because for so long, I carried that as it was my fault. I felt as though I was not truly loved by other people. A lot of that had to do with being gay. I felt there was just something inherently wrong with me, and I was not lovable. But I kept myself from everybody. I thought that nobody would want to get to know me because there was something wrong with me. And so I intentionally kept myself from other people for so long. In the initial stages of my experience with alcohol, there was a lot of relief and comfort. But of course, in retrospect, I understood that I was only using it to further keep myself from everybody, including myself. I didn't even want to be with my own self, and so I would dissociate and punish myself by getting drunk to try to become another person. And early on in my sobriety, I had several existential crises where I realized that I didn't know who I was. The feeling is almost of arriving in your adulthood but being a child. You don't know very much about yourself, and I was terrified to to get to know myself as my real self, because my whole adult life was just spent drunk. And so since that was taken away, I had to figure out what I wanted to do with my life. My last drink was June 7th, 2020. That was shortly before I met with the investigator of the Board of Nursing. I think that if that meeting had gone in another direction, I would have continued to drink. I think that if she hadn't been able to display that sense of caring and reach that hand out to help me, then I would have kept drinking. Just seeing the sadness on the investigator's face when she cried, just knowing that my life actually mattered to somebody, that was really touching for me. This person, who was probably the last person I would suspect to be helpful to me, she was the one that did the most to save me. Every day is different. At this point, I'm 2.5 years sober. I still have days where I will imagine, you know, a cold beer. But that is quickly an afterthought, because the next thoughts that I have are of me having my backpack opened by the police, and that disgust on the administrator's face as she saw the drugs in my backpack. And it just takes me back to the complete helplessness that I felt in those moments. It's imperative for me to understand that addiction is a lifelong illness, but I think it's important that it does live with you, because I have learned how to take care of myself finally. I've learned how to love myself, and I know that all of that is just one drink away from going back to how it was. About 3 to 4 months into my monitoring program, I was allowed to return to work under several conditions. I could not have access to narcotic medication. I could not work night shifts. I could not work in specialized areas of nursing like the ICU or the ER. I had to start in a most kind of basic setting. I worked in a nursing home for a year, and I was just so grateful to be back at work and being able to use my license that I worked so hard to get. There were a lot of hard times. There was a lot of judgment from coworkers that found out my situation, and I just continued to focus on taking care of myself. And eventually, I was able to have some of those stipulations taken off of my contract. I landed a job in the operating room, in the recovery room, taking care of patients right out of surgery. So I'm a registered nurse in the post-anesthesia care unit. When you immediately leave the operating room after your surgery is completed, you go to the recovery room, or the PACU. Nurses like me are there to help monitor your vital signs, make sure that your blood pressure's being maintained, as well as trying to make you comfortable after surgery, which can be difficult. People experience a lot of pain after surgery. There's something very comforting about that role, being able to take care of people in such a vulnerable state. You're giving pain medications, you're keeping people warm, you're holding their hand while they cry, you're educating family and telling the family that what they need to expect after the surgery. It's all very immediate, and it's such an amazing experience to be able to do that, and it's very rewarding. It is said that connection is the opposite of addiction. The process of connecting with other people is so beyond your focus when you're addicted to something, because you grow further and further away from everybody until you're just left with whatever substance has taken hold of you. And I think that the most difficult part of the entire experience was combating the shame that comes along with addiction and the things that it inspires you to do, like stealing and lying and planning to commit suicide and leave everybody behind to mourn for you. Shame is something that I think people in recovery carry with them forever. But through making amends and making connections with people, it helps combat that shame. You have to be able to manipulate your shame and use it in a way that's beneficial. And I've definitely found my humanity. I had to learn how to care and love for myself before I could start to offer that to my patients. It takes a lot of practice to learn how to take care of yourself properly. And it's something that I had definitely neglected throughout my life because I didn't think that I was worth taking care of. But I have such a better grasp on myself. I'm able to take care of other people because I take care of myself.
Today's guest requested to remain anonymous, but if you'd like to contact him, you can email at m298037@gmail.com. That's M as in Mary, 298037@gmail.com.
From Wondery, you're listening to This Is Actually Happening. If you love what we do, please rate and review the show. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, or on the Wondery app to listen ad-free and get access to the entire back catalog. In the episode notes, you'll find some links and offers from our sponsors. By supporting them, you help us bring you our show for free. I'm your host, Whit Misseldine. Today's episode was co-produced by me and Jason Blaylock, with special thanks to the This Is Actually Happening team, including Ellen Westberg. The intro music features the song Illibi by Tipper. You can join the community on the This Is Actually Happening discussion group on Facebook or follow us on Instagram at Actually Happening. On the show's website, thisisactuallyhappening.com, you can find out more about the podcast, contact us with any questions, submit your own story, or visit the store, where you can find This Is Actually Happening designs on stickers, t-shirts, wall art, hoodies, and more. That's thisisactuallyhappening.com. And finally, if you'd like to become an ongoing supporter of what we do, go to patreon.com/happening. Even $2 to $5 a month goes a long way to support our vision. Thank you for listening. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to This Is Actually Happening ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.